Coming up next, it's a special edition of the Season Watch Pod, produced by KAXE, People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota, celebrating 50 years of that People Powered Radio, of people and voices that you have come to know and love and trust, people like John Latimer. John is always helping us understand what might be blooming right now, what to look forward to, and a sneak peek into his yard and the baby eaglet or eaglets that he has been watching in a nest. Each week on Tuesday mornings for more than 42 years, I believe, John Latimer has been giving us notes on nature. We also get to hear students from around the state of Minnesota. Funding for the Phenology Talkbacks is provided in part by the Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. We're going to hear one of those reports right now from the students in Little Falls.
This is Cora
and Brielle
reporting from Little Falls Middle School. This is our phenology report for the week of May 3rd.
We have seen more and more green downers flying around in yards and meadows, and water striders are showing up on ponds and the rivers.
After the rain we received on the 23rd, the roads near red maple trees were covered in a red coating from the flowers that fell.
We also noticed that the grass turned a bright green color after the first rain.
We have been able to spot marsh marigolds in wet areas and bloodroot and hepatica in the woods, along with the first trout lilies.
A classmate drove past a cattail slough and saw 7 or 8 red-winged blackbirds all in some type of display.
Mr. Kaditz had a new bird this week as he heard and recorded a Louisiana water thrush at the state park. Merlin identified it 5 times, but he could not get a look at it, so he is counting it with an asterisk.
The catkins of the paper birch are several inches long and quite noticeable these days.
One student was able to capture and get some pictures of a large state beetle in her yard, and another spotted a gray fox.
Some fun bird sightings this week were the eastern phoebe, tree swallows, a belted kingfisher, and a rare Lincoln sparrow was our 100th species for the year.
The yellow-rumped warblers seem to be everywhere this week, and they do seem to like the suet at our feeders.
That is our report for this week. Until next week,
keep exploring, keep discovering, and keep connecting with the great outdoors.
Thanks to our reporters there from Chad Kaditz's class at Little Falls Middle School. They talked about the green darners that they have been spotting in Little Falls. I can't wait to see dragonflies and green darners again. Have you seen any? You can text us at 218-326-1234. Up next, it is John Latimer, our staff phenologist, and his full nature report for this week.
It's time for the Phenology Show. Phenology is the rhythmic biological nature of events as they relate to climate. And topping my list this week, well, there are a lot of things that I wanted to talk about first, but I'm going to just mention that we just got a note saying that the aspens were beginning to leaf out in Longville, which means they should be leafing out here in Grand Rapids today or tomorrow. We will see, and you will hear a lot more about aspens in the next 15 minutes or so. But before we get to the aspens, I want to cover some of the other stuff that's going on in my life. One, and I think this is by far the most exciting, if you'd been sitting in my house on Friday afternoon when I was looking through the spotting scope at the eagle's nest and finally realized that there were 2 eaglets in the nest, you would understand just what sort of a person I am. I was as excited as a child at Christmas. I was hooting and hollering. My wife was just like, "What is going on?" I go, there are two. Ooh, we have 2 eaglets. Oh, what a thrilling day. I had seen earlier this week, I'd seen one. It got to be this about the size of a pigeon, and it was getting active, and it was harder for it to hide in the nest. I'm looking from down below, so I have this problem where I'm seeing the edge of the nest and then kind of up into space, and so I can't see what's in the nest, what's down in the depression of the nest, but eventually, the birds get big enough and active enough that they start showing up and I only have this small window because I'm looking through a stand of red maple, birch, and tamarack. And all of those plants are rapidly leafing out, flowering out, and it will only be another week or so, and my view to the nest will be obstructed, and I won't be able to see what's going on there right now. But for the time being, I'm a pretty excited little grandfather here, if you can call me the grandfather of those baby eaglets. I'm pretty excited. And there are two of them, and that is just wonderful. I hope they both survive. Their parents seem to be really good. They're bringing a lot of food to the nest and are pretty attentive. So I'm hoping that that those two will make it to juvenile stage, to fledging, and getting on. And speaking of fledging, my ravens, the common raven nest, which is just east of me, the eagle's nest is west, the raven's nest is east. The boundary appears to be right over my house. When the eagle comes in from the river and goes over the raven's territory, the raven gets up and he has this one particular call that is kind of a repetitious keck, 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 keck. And when I hear that, I know the eagle is coming. But this last week, I have heard that call frequently, even more frequently than the eagles coming around. And I don't know if the parents are teaching their juvenile, newly fledged babies how to curse at an eagle, or if this is another call that they use that they say the same thing to the eagle that they're saying to their kids. I don't know. But I do know that all four of the little young ones have fledged, and they're all flying about. And this year, they didn't take the nest apart. Yeah, that happens. The baby ravens sometimes get a little bored, and they'll deconstruct the nest and drop it on the ground. It's happened a couple times, and mom usually puts up with it and then comes back and puts the nest all back together again for the next year. So the eagles are hanging out. Let's see. There are trumpeter swans on the lake. I expect they'll be nesting. There's a common loon. 2 years ago, one common loon lost its mate, came back, called, never found a mate, left in June. Last year, the loon came back, called and called and called, and picked up a mate. But they weren't successful at raising a young one. I saw two loons on the lake pretty much all summer, but no juveniles. And this year, I have only seen a single loon. He hasn't done a lot of calling. It could be that I'm just not there at the right time. I have to walk by the eagle's nest in order to get to the lake, and so I try to keep that disturbance down to maybe twice a week, where I sort of amble past the eagle's nest and try to pretend like I'm just another deer walking down the trail. So anyway, one loon, and hopefully another one will find its way to the pond. I mentioned that I had a single evening grosbeak male at my feeder this past week, along with, the white-throated sparrows, the white-crowned sparrow, the song sparrow, the red-winged blackbirds, male and female. The female blackbirds are back now. Don't be fooled. They don't look at all like the male. They're brown. They're kind of mottled. They're not... If you are confused, look at the beak. Look at the beak of the male red-winged blackbird, which is pretty easily identified. And the female has basically the same color, same shape beak as the male. And that is one way that you can separate them out. Right now, there aren't any rose-breasted grosbeak females in the nest or in the area to confuse you. But when they come back, they're going to look quite a bit like the female red-winged blackbird. So just get out there and check them out, and hopefully you'll be able to check out which ones are which. Among the insects, variegated meadowhawk. It's a dragonfly. I have not seen one. Dallas Hudson reported that. The American painted lady butterfly, seen by John Weber over in Nevis. And at my house, Those little red ants that make the little volcano-like structures in your driveway, you know, the little dirt piles that look like tiny volcanoes, they are up and active. That is a member of the Lazius group. I can't remember if it's a Finnis or Neo-Niger. It doesn't matter. It's a small red ant, and it makes these little conical-shaped sort of volcano-like piles of sand where it digs out its nest, and they have become active again this past week. And the Allegheny mound ant, the ant that makes those big dirt mounds, they've been active for a couple of weeks now. That's the advantage of creating a home that invites the sun to shine on it and warm it up earlier than just the little Lazius ants that are living in the ground and come up when things finally do warm up enough for them to get out and get about. Among the flowers, the nodding and the large-flowered trilliums are up, but not yet blooming. They're not even close to blooming. They're only up about 2 inches right now. Wood anemone is up. Canada columbine is up. Large-flowered asters are up. All of these plants are just the plants. They're just emerging from the ground. The violets in my yard, the blue violets in my yard, those leaves are up, but no flowers. Tansy, same thing. It is up, but no flowers. Blueberries, sort of breaking bud and flowering. Labrador tea in the woods or in the swamps is just starting to flower. Hepaticas, those lovely 5 to 7 petaled flowers out in the woods are blooming. I have pink and light blue and darker blue and white. They are just lovely. If you come across a fairly large, like 3/4 inch across flower head in a variety of colors, look at the stem of the flower. If it is very, very hairy, chances are that it's a hepatica. And there should be a 1.5 to 2 inch wide, 3-lobed leaf, which gives the hepatica its name. And that leaf is evergreen, so it's going to have overwintered. Some of them are stained with a little bit of reddish stain, which might tell you that they are older leaves. The brand new leaves will be sort of a bright green. Among the shrubs, Juneberry, I can see the flower buds, although they're not budding, they're not flowering yet, but you can see where the flowers will be. Chokecherry, the same thing. Pincherries are the same. I can see flower buds. None of these are close to flowering. When they do flower, it will be Juneberry, Pincherry, Chokecherry in that order. And if you have plums in your neighborhood, they'll bloom about the same time as the Juneberries. The smooth rose in my front yard is breaking leaf bud. You can see little dots of green along those red stems. Leather wood, which doesn't grow at my house, but does grow in a lot of areas that I frequent, is, if it's not at its peak, it's very close. It is very close to being at peak flower right now. The fly honeysuckle, the native honeysuckle, is budded. The leaves are budded out, and you can see the flower heads where they're going to be in flower, but they are not yet in flower. The native honeysuckle is yellow. If you have a honeysuckle in your yard and it has pink or pink and white flowers on it, it is an invasive honeysuckle. And at my house, that plant would get pulled up and gotten rid of, because as with so many of those plants, the birds come along, eat the berries, fly over, take a dump, and plant another Tartarian honeysuckle somewhere nearby. The hazels, both the beaked and the American hazel, are done flowering, and I'm right at the stage where the leaves are starting to break bud. And the same is true with the pagoda dogwoods, and the nanny berries are leafed out. That is to say, they have their buds on the nanny berries are so open that I can see the leaf stem, and that's really the dividing line. So it's bud break until you can see a leaf stem. Once you can see a leaf stem, then it is no longer bud break, but leaf out. And then it is increasing leaf size until about mid-June, at which point they're sort of done growing their leaves. And after that, it's either new growth with leaves on it, or it is just the plant taking the energy from those fully grown leaves and sequestering it in the roots for next year. Let me see a long list here. That brings us to the aspens. And normally the trembling aspens would leaf out on the 30th of April. And as I look at my records on the aspens, on the trembling aspens, they are actually getting later. There is a tendency, the trend for the aspens, the trembling aspens, is to leaf out later than they did back in the 80s. The big tooth aspen appears to have no change. That trend line is absolutely flat. Usually there's about an 18-day gap between the leaf out of the trembling aspen and the leaf out of the big tooth aspen. The trembling aspen bud burst is typically the 30th of April. As I mentioned, the bud burst on the big tooth aspen is typically the 17th of April, or May, I'm sorry, the 17th of May. Among the earliest of the trembling aspen leaf outs, April 3rd in 2012, April 15th in 1987, April 16th in 2005, and April 18th in 2006. For the big tooth aspen, the earliest that I've noticed them leafing out is May 2nd in 87, May 4th in 98, May 8th in both 1985 and in 2003. And the latest that I ever had the aspens leaf out was the 16th of May in, these are the trembling aspens, the 16th of May in 96, the 17th of May in 2014, the 14th of May in 2008, and the 13th of May in 2022. On the big tooth side, the latest I ever had bud burst was May 30th, both in 1990 and in 2014, and May 29th in 2008, and May 28th in 2004. So some kind of a switch around there. And then I got to looking at a bunch of different things, and like if the trembling aspen is late to leaf out, which indicates kind of a cold spring, what effect does that have, or how does it affect other plants when you go looking at all of them? So marsh marigold and American tamarack both have a very high correlation between their blooming dates and leaf out dates and the leaf out date of the trembling aspen. Both are early spring plants, so they're reading the same thermal cues. American and beaked hazel are right in there as well, and Pennsylvania sedge, wild white violets all have a reliable and sort of intimate relationship with the leafing out of the aspens. So if it's a late year for those, it's going to be a late year for all those others. And going on, looking into later spring, all of the flowering, all of these flowering plants are pushed later when aspen is later. Large flowered bellwort, lady fern, bracken fern, low bush blueberry, fly honeysuckle, choke cherry, Canada Mayflower, wild sarsaparilla, and purple clematis all show some relationship to late flowering of, or late leaf out of the aspens. Now, which plants don't then have a relationship with aspens? Pussy willows. With 40 years of record, there's essentially zero correlation between pussy willows and trembling aspens. It makes sense. Pussy willows respond very early to early snow melt and soil temperature clues, often weeks before the thermal warmth that drives the leaf bud burst to even register. Dandelions are similar with a near zero correlation. Some flowers don't care. Common mullein, black-eyed Susan, Canada silk, evening primrose, spotted touch-me-not, blue flag, basswood, all have zero correlation or very low correlation with early or late flower or leaf out of the aspens. So those plants, those are mostly summer plants, by the way, but you're not going to see most of those plants being later as a result of the mild or cold spring. Common blackberry and dwarf raspberry also are not likely to be too influenced. And in fact, they tend slightly in the opposite direction. So blackberry and dwarf raspberry can leaf out earlier in a year when the aspens leaf out later. And right down at the bottom of the list, and those that don't give a rip about what the aspen does, are blue vervain and boneset. And boneset is one of those midsummer sort of swampy plants that comes along and blooms and couldn't care less. But then when you think about the interval between, there is plenty of reason to suspect not much of a correlation there. I guess what I'm trying to say is we are headed toward a late, but not latest ever, leaf out for the aspens, and it's going to push everything else just a little bit, well, most everything else, just a little bit later as well. That's the Phenology Show for this week. As always, if you have comments, questions, or observations to share, please send them along. We love to hear from you.
Jen Latimer's weekly Phenology Report here on People Powered KEXE. I'm Heidi Holton. Thanks for tuning in this weekend. Up next, as we celebrate 50 years of People Powered KEXE, we are dipping into the archives. You're going to hear a couple of voices that you may recognize here. We're hearing from Scott Hall, the former host of The Morning Show, and the late Harry Hutchins.
I'm with Harry Hutchins. He's a forest ecologist and teaches at Itasca Community College in the forestry program. He just gave a final exam for his students this semester, and it sounds like a fascinating project. What'd you have them do?
Well, having done this now for 29 years, you always try to come up with something a little bit different. And this was my ecosystem management class, and what I did was I did give them a little bit of a written exam earlier, but I thought, you know, they had an assignment all semester long where they had to look at the landscape level conditions at there's a 496 acre forest or agricultural lands right next to the college, and that's owned by the University of Minnesota. What I told them to do was for the next 50 years to try and create and maintain biodiversity on that ground, and don't let it decrease any.
What do you have there?
Well, mostly it's pine forest, and most of it is red pine, white pine, and that was the ecosystem that was there. You can go back to the 1880s and look at what it was before the university began to change it a bit and bring in cattle or do some agronomy soils experiments or some crop experiments, things like that. And they all have a place in this ecosystem. As the students brought up, I mean, there are some openings, open ground, plus they need to continue that. I mean, it's not like we're telling the university, shut down all your experiments. That's not the whole purpose of this. I wanted to have them look at it in context, try and think about of what their goals are, but also try and think about, well, okay, what can we say to the university and say, well, this is a big green space in Itasca County, especially around Grand Rapids. So this big green space has a role trying to, as far as the wildlife, microbes and trees and shrubs and everything out there, it has a big role here in this urban area. And I thought it would be great to maintain it because people use this, whether it's for skiing or for research or for just walking around and hiking and doing bird watching, whatever it may be. So we've had everything in the last 2 years there, from moose to microbes to white-tailed deer, coyotes. People have even seen wolf tracks back there recently. So it's a pretty diverse area. And, of course, it also borders, and on both sides, the university owns land on the Prairie River, which is probably about a fourth-order stream that dumps into the Mississippi. Pretty good-sized stream. So you have some interesting wetlands associated with that. Some of the students brought up to try and increase wild rice production there. And they realized that this river is a connection to the land, because you have so many amphibians that go down there to breed, or reptiles, or mammals like otters and things that might come back up on the upland, but so many animals have to go there to breed or at least get a drink or maybe catch their food like a raccoon. Well, they need a safe way to get from that riparian area, that river, back up to the upland forest and maybe the pines, ponds there and things like that, like a lot of the amphibians that we're hearing now calling, the frogs and things. So,
how'd the students do?
I was just amazed. I was just grinning and sometimes almost had a tear coming from it. I'm thinking, oh, man, they got it. And, you know, because it's not just this one class. It's kind of a culmination of everything we've been trying to teach them over the last 2 years. And this is, to me, a capstone class. In 10, 12 minutes, they put it all together. And I hope somebody thinks about it two or three times, or maybe not too long, and hires them, because they'd be very happy with this group.
Nice. What were a few elements of their plan?
Oh, a few elements. Again, some of the specifics were, yeah, they were putting in larger culverts, like on County Road B, so the animals didn't get smashed, and were moving from the river. They could use, you know, turtles and things, and other mammals, like raccoon-sized mammals, would be able to move to the upland and back to the water safely. They certainly were pushing more for multi-age stands instead of the even-age plantations that seems to dominate that landscape currently. Again, using the edge, realizing that not all edge is bad, and some of the edge and the woods, using the fence rows, restoring the wood duck, the bluebird boxes that have been taken down on the edges of the agricultural lands, things like that. And of course, they know me, so they were all into the deadwood and making sure the down logs. And they took surveys of how many down logs were there and compare them to what should be there in those kinds of ecosystems, as well as the standing dead trees and things like that.
You like dead and down. Tell us why.
Well, here in, for example, in the Chippewa National Forest, which borders our community, there's 60 species that require standing dead trees, or snags, as people like to call them. Snags that needed for breeding, or feeding, or doing both.
Is this mostly birds?
I'm sorry. Is it mostly birds? Probably.
Uh-huh.
But that's things with backbones. There's, if we started getting into the insects, it'd be a lot more. But the vertebrates, the land vertebrates, not fish, but the land vertebrates, it would be birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians.
Okay.
And there's another 66 species that require down logs for some part of their life history, breeding, feeding, and or doing both. And so those 66 need down logs that are at least 6 or 8 inches in diameter and maybe 6 feet in length or something like that. Yeah. Okay. So that's a, you know, that's probably one of the, especially in clean forest activities, we tend not to really promote those in a lot of cases, but that's probably one of the limiting objects out there, structural objects that we don't have in our forest that we need to, and then maintaining those is another whole thing because trees die. Well, there's got to be some other dead trees coming along there. And so at least putting that into your objectives that it needs to be there and thinking about that and making sure that, you know, if you take a look at my front yard now, I have 2 dead trees. And one of them has been an oak tree that's been dead now for 13 years.
It's standing.
It's still standing. And we've had 5 different pairs of woodpeckers using that, as well as the chickadees and nuthatches and other species too. But you know, direct cavity makers is so important. And you know, Scott, just to digress a little bit, the king of the cavity makers that you really want to make sure are hanging around here, and they not only eat ants like crazy on the ground, but the flickers, the common northern flicker, that's the one that makes most of the cavities that other secondary cavity nesters, like flying squirrels, or like a tree frog, or like a great crested flycatcher, will use later. So the northern flicker is. And they love to make them in aspen trees. I would say secondarily, the second big one is yellow-bellied sapsuckers.
You spent some time last week down in Aiken County with the foresters there. What'd you do?
Well, boy, we got lucky. It's always lucky to go down there. And I have to say that they have been so kind that Mark Jacobs, the land commissioner there, pulled out a piece of paper. The second time I went down there this week, I took 2 different groups down there, and he pulls out this paper and he says, "Harry, look." And sure enough, this was the 20th year that I had been down there with a class, and so it had the date on there. And so, anyways, we've been doing this for 20 years, but this was a little bit different. He changed up things a little bit because I asked him to talk about black ash. You notice I said that very slowly and carefully. You can make a lot of jokes about that, and I'm sure that you people can make their own with that. But black ash, of course, has really gotten a lot of notoriety, maybe for the negative reasons, just because of this new invasive species that has come to our attention that affects all ash trees. And we are looking mostly at black ash, and this... Emerald ash borer, of course, is something that we need to be aware of. But one of the things they're trying to do is say, okay, yeah, we're aware of it. We'll try and get some diversity in these stands. Maybe a little bur oak, maybe a little bit of northern white cedar, depending on how wet the site is.
Black ash do like a wet site, don't they?
Yeah, and some sites, though, are wetter than others. And there is one plant community, I should let the listeners know, there is one wet or one ash community, excuse me, that is a fire dependent community. And our friend John Allmendinger likes to say that, you know, ash is a species that's been able to colonize just about any site. And if there's an opening, if there's some way it can push itself in, it'll try and get into it. And sometimes, or several times, I mean, it is a species. One of those ashes, green ash, black ash, or white ash, seems to be able to get into more native plant communities than any other tree species out there. So there is one fire-dependent community because we've eliminated fire, that it's begun to establish in. And this is green ash that's primarily doing that. But... So
what about their Aiken County's black ash approach?
So what they're doing is these little half-acre group selection cuts.
What does that mean?
So they're doing, they might do selective harvest throughout much of the stand, typical northern hardwoods type thing. But primarily what they're doing is they're trying to make little openings, make little gaps in the forest, the entire forest of primarily that's dominated by black ash. And in that, they want to see what kind of regeneration comes in. Now, some ash stands are wetter than others. And if you open the ash stand too much, guess what happens? Water comes up because these things are like big straws sucking up water. All trees are, but especially ash grows in wet sites. So if you went at this and you took too many trees out, then you would end up turning your forest into a cattail marsh. And of course, that's not what you want to do. So they got to be careful and not take too many trees out. So you take these half-acre patch cuts throughout the forest or in several places, and they want to see what comes in. Not raise the water level too much. And, some white might be more northern white cedar and maybe white spruce. Some might be some of the, they're getting box elder in some of these. Plants that we don't know what really comes in, regenerates, and they want to see what's going to, because if they can get some diversity in there, then if the emerald ash borer does come, then there's going to be a lot of stuff left. And it's not going to turn over into a cattail marsh because there's always going to be trees regenerating there. Maybe we're going to lose some of the ash. Maybe we'll be able to keep a lot of it around. We have so much to learn on this. And of course, doing things like just thinnings and things like that to, again, promote good health in the stand and make them growing vigorously might also help in trying to keep these forests around in the landscape.
That's the late Harry Hutchins. He was an instructor at Minnesota North Itasca, known as Itasca Community College, and he taught forest ecology and was a longtime host here on KAXE. He was speaking there with Scott Hall. Remembering back 50 years of people-powered KAXE. When you look for Season Watch on the KAXE.org website, check out SpeakPipe and leave us a message. What are you seeing or what are you hearing? I'm Heidi Holton for Season Watch on KAXE. When you tune into KAXE, you'll hear our phenology students reminding us to pay attention to nature.
Hello from Mr. Masakovic's class at Baxter Elementary School. This past week brought our first substantial rainfall on one day.
Canadian thistle has popped up.
Greetings from the fourth grade phenology team in the Linwood School Forest. This is Eliza,
Charlie, and Mary
reporting on our observations for the week ending May 1st.
This week we observed our lilac have many sets of leaves on it.
Hi, this is Carson
and Reese from Crooked Lake Elementary School in Andover, reporting from Long Lake Conservation Center for April 29th through May 1st. The weather was sunny but cool with a high temperature of 48 degrees Fahrenheit.
This concludes the phenology report. Have a great week and be observant.
Keep exploring, keep discovering, and keep connecting with the great outdoors.
KAXE celebrating 50 years of people-powered radio.